Hello, this is Dan Le Batard. Welcome to what is informally the first episode of the South Beach Sessions. It's our new original podcast series kicking off the Le Batard and Friends podcast network. We announced last week on the radio that that will be coming in the new year, along with some stuff that you could get at a merch store we're opening. But it's just going to be a little bit of stuff at the beginning. If you missed our announcement, this is the first of a series of original podcasts our team will be creating under a Le Batard and Friends umbrella. It's going to be published basically weekly in a podcast feed completely separate from where you listen to the radio show. And you're going to be able to get the podcast, subscribe to it, and all the places you could get the podcast of the radio show. After this episode, we'll start our regular schedule January 8th. We're going to have Neil Brennan on, the co-creator of the Chappelle Show. And the idea of this is to get away from sports and just have honest conversations with interesting people in entertainment and music and comedy. So let me tell you why it is that we started with Jemele Hill and why I think you'll find this interesting. The idea of John Skipper, the president of ESPN, he wanted ESPN to be broader, global, more international, more diverse. The Six was started with Jemele Hill and Michael Smith, and then it ran against everything changing in politics with Donald Trump being elected, and Jemele Hill had a public fight with Donald Trump, and it put John Skipper and Disney and a bunch of people in a bad position, and the Six ended up disappearing. And I want you to know a little more about Jemele Hill so you understand who this person is that I've respected for a long time. She's a journalism dork. She is a bit of an accidental activist. We will talk to her about that. But whatever it is that people think of Jemele Hill, that she's militant, she's racist, or whatever the criticisms you think should be lobbed at Jemele Hill, I'm telling you, as someone I've known for 25 years, that she is a journalism dork who just sort of cares about the sports stories and stumbled into this activism. Like, she cares about black people. She voices opinions on behalf of black people. But that wasn't the cause. That wasn't the intent. That not, all of that happened to her. She wasn't looking for that, and she's certainly not comfortable with it. But we'll cover all that with her, and those are the kind of conversations I want to have with people like this. Just so you know, by the way, as we work this out and we find our voice on these and we establish an extended podcast network, I want you to know we're going to be a little looser with the language, the subject matter in the podcast than what you typically hear on the radio show. We're not looking to be an F-bomb fest, but we're aware that this format allows us to explore areas that don't work on live radio and TV for a variety of reasons. And this is part of that. So, as a favor, before Jemele Hill and what I think was an interesting start to this, please subscribe, take a listen, give your feedback with a rating, a review. Constructive criticism is welcome. We're going to be building this over the course of the next few years, so we do want input. We do not mind on that. But let's start with Jemele Hill. So I wanted to talk to Jemele Hill about a number of different things. I think she knows how much I've admired her over her entire career, and I've seen some of the things that happened to her and with her at ESPN, and it was disorienting, and some of it felt very unfair, and there were many times that I just I felt like you were very lonely. You didn't have the kind of support that I wish you had, and so I just wanted to talk to you about all of the things that happened. I don't think that people understand when they hear the name Jemele Hill and whatever that's associated with these days, where people take a human being and make them a symbol for something and then they stop being a human being. They're just that symbol. I don't think that people understand that you are, I mean, is it fair to call you an accidental activist?
Yeah, that's fair. The activist part is still very odd for me to hear because I've explained to people repeatedly that journalists aren't really supposed to be activists. Our awareness, us bringing attention to things, us shedding light on things, us making you think, that's our activism. So I still get a little uncomfortable that people consider me more in that space than the journalism space.
Well, you're a journalism dork, right? You are like like all of us who came up at ESPN, who come up through the newspapers. You just happen to be the only black woman, or almost only, I guess. No, pretty much. I mean, you're the pioneer here, but among the journalism dorks in newspapers, you are more like us than you are Malcolm X.
Yeah, big time. I mean, I'm a journalism nerd. I mean, I've known since I was in high school that I wanted to be a sports writer in particular. And, you know, like you, you grow up in this business. You're trained a certain way. You're trained to think of things a certain way. And the idea of making yourself the story in any way was abhorrent for most of my career. Every journalist I respect that mentored me, nurtured me, they always said, like, don't make yourself the story. You know, that was a credo of this business. So with that in mind, I mean, it just felt so weird for so long. I guess even now, that every time I say something, I do something, that it's a story. And I never really liked being the center of attention, despite the fact I'm in a business that positions you as that. There's a part of this whole journey that feels very awkward for me that I've had to get used to.
It's funny to look at it, or I guess maybe it's not so funny, but the idea that you didn't ask for any of this and that your greatest crimes, as far as I can see them, if people believe you to be a criminal, your greatest crimes are being Black and having opinions and experiences that were shaped by being Black.
And don't forget being a woman. You know, that kind of is... you can't separate either one of those. But yeah, I mean, that was kind of the gist of it. It's been that way through a lot of my career, that other columnists who don't look like me could say the same thing I would say, or something similar, and would not receive any of some of the backlash that I would experience. And this obviously was taken to another level because I had a very specific criticism about the president that was about race, and in terms of how I felt as if he were looking at the marginalized and vulnerable people in this country. So if you add that cocktail of social media, you know, where I worked with what I said and who it was supposed to be the storm that it became.
Your life changed from 1 minute to the next, correct?
And it changed in a dramatic way. This was not something that I was able to ease into. It was overnight. Really, I wouldn't even say overnight, within hours. My life changed forever.
Tell me about that. Can you tell me what those hours were like? I'm curious.
Well, it was like watching a huge boulder roll down, you know, hill at an amazing speed. At first, it started off kind of slow. And then as the tweets picked up and as more people started to talk about them, as more outlets wrote about them, it was just a full-fledged just shitstorm. Really, that's the best way I can put it. And, you know, it went from, okay, this is just a story in conservative circles, to, okay, this is a national story, to, okay, suddenly at a press conference, the White House is saying you should be fired. So that just happened in a matter of days.
Scary, right?
Yeah, because as you might imagine, you know, there was a lot of response. You know, the letters I received, I had to have my voicemail at ESPN shut off because I was getting threatened every other call. And they even had to undertake some security measures because there was a couple protests at the ESPN campus in Bristol. Protests, I should say, that were in support of me, actually. Their phone lines were being totally lit up. And, you know, I knew that the conversations in the C-suites were probably about whether or not I deserved to be fired over this. So it was a lot going on.
And so, as it happens, when do you start to realize, oh, wait, this is a worthy fight. This might go against my journalism principles of staying out of a story, but now I'm the accidental activist. Now I've actually got experiences that qualify me to speak on behalf of a people, and speak on behalf of a gender, and in a presidency that can be hostile to both. What was that like when you realized, how long did it take you to realize, wait a minute, this might not be such a bad thing?
Well, I knew actually almost immediately that if I did face, you know, some kind of permanent discipline, if I did lose my job, if I was immediately suspended, I was okay with it because I didn't think what I said was untruthful. And, you know, I think I would have felt worse if I felt as if I took a shot at somebody who didn't deserve it, or some of the other kind of common things that happen in our business. If I felt like it was a mistake in what I said, then I probably would have felt bad about it, but I never did. And, you know, in terms of me realizing that this could be a good thing, that this could be a positive, I think that wasn't something I realized until after I was suspended. You know, because I took that suspension time to really reflect and to think about it, and to some degree get away from it. I spent some, you know, I really wasn't on social media. I mean, I have a pretty tight inner circle, so I spent time with them. And after that, when people, when some of the requests were pouring in and different people that want to hear from me and speak to me, then I realized that this could go to a level that I didn't even anticipate that it could go to. I mean, when you have Jesse Jackson calling and praying with you, you know, that is, that's mind boggling. And I know everybody, there's a part of you that wants to laugh at this, but that legitimately happened.
No, it is great. I love to think of the idea of Jesse, you picking up the phone, it's Jesse Jackson with all of that entails.
Exactly.
And
what
then on top of that, that he asks you to pray with him is exactly what Jesse Jackson would do. So it had to be sort of spiritual, surreal, cartoonish, weird.
It was. Even that moment, it was, I told one of my girls, I was like, I wasn't supposed to laugh at that, but there is something comical about picking up the phone and hearing Jesse Jackson's voice, which is very distinct. Right?
I love the idea. I love the idea of you making the stand there. I don't know what your religious principles are, but just sort of, I don't want to pray right now. You can't even do that, can you? If Jesse Jackson calls you to pray, you gotta pray.
I don't care if you're an atheist, like, you better pray. You better learn one right there, okay? Just be silent and reflect if you don't.
I remember talking to you while some of this stuff was happening, and you and Michael, well, let me tell the listeners some of the backstory here that they may not know. John Skipper, as president of this company, had a great deal of difficulty sort of getting strength and power into office and through voices that were minority. And so what he did is he empowered a bunch of people like you and me to go start our fires. And so John Skipper was very much an advocate in your corner at the highest levels of the company. I'm just not sure how much support you had beneath that for trying something that was different at 6 o'clock, something that was going to be black at 6 o'clock. And then I don't know how even long it lasted, but if they'd taken either one of our shows off the air as fast as they took yours off the air, we would have never succeeded. Like if they were making the judgment on our radio show or our television show and the span that you had to do work on ESPN, we would have also been fired.
Well, technically it went 13 months, but really it felt much shorter than that because the entire direction of the show changed months before I actually left it. And it was because the direction had changed so drastically that I just no longer had it in me to do it. And it wasn't who I was. It was something I'd never been since I started at ESPN. I mean, I started here as a columnist, or I should say started there because I'm no longer here. Uh-huh. See, it's still weird. 12 years, that's what happens. But no, I started there as a columnist, and so I've always been in that lane of commentary, giving my opinion, critical thinking.
They turned you into an anchor? They turned you into a SportsCenter anchor.
They didn't want us to – they took away two major strengths of our show. The whole reason they asked us to do SportsCenter, and I always like to repeat that, they asked us. We didn't go looking for this mission, okay? We were recruited. And the whole reason they did is because they thought Mike and I had great chemistry.
Which you do.
Which we do. We're great friends. And they took that part away. We were barely talking to each other in the show in terms of how the format had been
changed.
You
were doing television. You were doing the act of television as opposed to everything in your career that had been televised to that point, which was just accents on your friendship.
Correct. And so it changed from we weren't talking to each other to we were no longer allowed to give our opinion. We were allowed to put opinions in the show. They just weren't ours. Okay. And I think it was meant to try to alleviate some of the issues that they felt like we were having. And the funny thing is, it's like, had they just let it ride out, we would have, because we had changed so much about the show from day one. You know, we were trying to have some of those longer conversations that we had on His and Hers early on. We stopped that because we realized the pacing did not work at 6 o'clock. It wasn't the same. So we became a much faster show in the summer to get to things quickly. And, you know, we were kind of along that evolution, but we still wanted our chemistry to be the foundation of the show. And I think that, you know, once the show changed direction, there was this feeling that we had to return to old SportsCenter. And then, of course, once the controversy happened with me, that gave them even more reason to do it. So it was like two things were happening. The show was already changing before the Donald Trump stuff happened. But once that happened, they really doubled down on overcorrection.
Skipper was mad at you, too.
Oh, no. I've never seen him that mad. Never. And he was, I mean, just beside himself and swearing. And the funny thing is, before he started, you know, before his anger became visible, he said, he was very calm and he said, you know, I learned being married for 25 years mm-hmm. that you never say things in anger because you're going to inevitably say something that you can't take back and you should be calm. And, you know, so I'm glad I'm talking to you now. And when it didn't first happen, and then literally 5 minutes later, he's yelling at me. He's yelling at me. I was like, but what happened to that whole anger conversation we just had?
Are you buying the idea, though? Because I thought I bought from him the idea that that he would have been okay if you had invited that controversy on the platform you'd been given versus on Twitter, on one of the biggest platforms. I believe him when he says that if you'd just done it there, I could run cover for you, but not on social media when we've got so many rules about social media. And now you've engaged the president of the United States against Disney, which is a company that doesn't want in these waters.
No.
Like, why would Disney want in these waters? Disney makes cartoons and money. That's not what Disney wants in on. They don't want in on politics. I thought that was fair by him to be mad about that. Why wouldn't you do it on the platform that he gave you?
It was accurate. But here, and to his point, what I said were things I had said before on TV. Like when we were His and Hers, and granted it's a different audience and it's at noon and it was on ESPN2, which was, you know, branded the personality commentary arm of the network. We, and even our podcast, we used to go in on him all the
time. That's crazy to think, Jamel. That's crazy to think that the avalanche that hit your world and changed it from 1 hour to the next was something that you were saying that you had said in some form before in many, many places, but it got hijacked and then it got thrown into the political, it became chum for the politics.
Now, granted, even at six, even saying it on the platform, I think it still becomes a story. I don't know how big of a story it becomes because before I said that on social media, you know, ESPN was fighting that truly stupid narrative about them being political and being liberal. And it was just funny to me. And you said this, and I could not. I mean, if you had a collection plate, I would have thrown one paycheck in there at least.
We would have prayed with Jesse Jackson.
Yes, we would have prayed with, before throwing it in the collection plate. But you said this, and it's so true, is that ESPN started being known as a liberal company as soon as the face of the company started to change. As in more black and brown people, certainly giving more gays and lesbians a platform.
But that was what Skipper did.
Yes, that was his legacy.
It was important to him.
Totally.
It was important to do that. And so his anger, how did you receive his anger? Because it's obviously the right and noble cause that you're fighting, and he would say so himself.
He would.
And yet here he is having to defend you against God knows what above him or what he has to do because he has to explain to shareholders, I don't know why we're fighting with the president of the United States.
Right. I dropped a hydrogen bomb in his lap. There's no question. And I received it. I was actually hurt. I wasn't hurt by what he said. I was hurt that I hurt him. And he has gone to bat for me many times. He's been a huge supporter throughout my career. And you know how he operated. He was one of the most likable, easy people to talk to. I could take any problem to him. I did not always disagree with him, but I could make that known too. And it was talking to him was always a safe space. So, unfortunately, knowing that I had disappointed him that much really hurt me. And I wasn't not from the sense of my comments, but just knowing that he was about to get to catch hell on my behalf. And the company that I had been at for 12 years was about to catch hell. And it's sort of like I just dangled meat in front of the wrong people. I might have said the right thing, but I dangled it in front of the wrong people. And so this has never happened to me in any meeting, certainly not with an executive. I actually cried in the meeting. I had tears coming out of my eyes because I saw how angry he was and how this had exploded on him at a time where he really needed peacetime.
Well, and you also know you know more than most what the greater cause was, because that is what happened at ESPN. The smart voices started to become women and brown and black, and that's where ESPN kind of became perceived as a liberal company.
Yeah, I mean, and which was insulting in itself because it said that basically all of us got our jobs and our platforms because ESPN was trying to be charitable. As I remind people, when I was a columnist for the Orlando Sentinel, I was the only black female sports columnist at a daily newspaper in North America. Not America, in North America. One out of 305. Does that sound like people are being charitable? No, it doesn't. And even if you look beyond ESPN and you look across all platforms and networks, a lot of us are not represented. So nobody's giving us shit. And so for that to be kind of the narrative that ESPN was just handing out jobs to these people who clearly don't deserve it.
Jamel, you earned it. Make it. You guys, before podcasts were podcasts, you guys made everything out of having a chemistry and two wires tied together.
We used to joke all the time. We selling tapes out the trunk. I mean, that was the narrative in our career. Nobody gave us anything. And everything that we got, it wasn't because somebody sat in a lab or sat, in an office somewhere and said, you know what would make sense? Giving them a show. You know, we won the war of attrition until we didn't.
I just think that if that show had been given time, that you guys
would have got there.
You guys would have ended up figuring it out. But you talk about a bomb going off. Like, all of America changed while your show was on. Like, the whole country changed.
And I think that is why, from the beginning, we got a lot of the shit that we did. And my disappointment was that we did not feel like we got enough cover during that time. Because out of the gate, before you even say anything on air, the narrative of your show, the story of your show has been totally written. And that's what it was for us, is that we were so different, almost too different, to the point where it was an immediate backlash, where that traditional 6 o'clock viewer didn't want to see what we did. Or we ran into numerous people who would say, oh, I loved you on His and Hers, but I don't like you on 6 o'clock. Well, what's the difference? It's 6 hours. I just want SportsCenter the way I know SportsCenter to be. And it's like, it has to evolve. Okay. At some point. Right. And I know, you know, you've been through this a lot. Readers and viewers, they don't love change, but sometimes you got to give them what they don't know they even want and be okay with whatever the results were. And so, you know, once people started writing stories about how we were failures and how ratings were bad, they were never bad.
Well, the executives, executives in television are always worried about what somebody's writing. Still, but you should like that as someone who comes from newspapers. You should feel good in 2018 that somehow that still matters somewhere. Yeah. Executives love to read those clippings. And if a TV critic is saying your show's no good, an executive can be influenced by
that. And, or just, you know, writing that. And then the other perfect storm was the layoffs happened. And of course, as is the case in our business, is that, you know, before you can even sign a contract, it seems like everybody knows what you're making or theorizing about how much money you're making. So there are layoffs. We get this prominent position. People know how much money that we're making or think they know or guessing. And all of a sudden, the two black people at 6 o'clock don't deserve to be here. And that was that we could not distance ourselves from that.
That happened so fast, Jamel. All of that happened within a couple months.
Like 2 months.
You were unhappy doing that show. How fast in?
Honestly, I knew we weren't going to make it in month three. I said that to Mike. I was like, look, I'm just telling you, I thought we would finish it out, because the way it worked is that we were guaranteed 3 years at six on a 4-year deal. And so I knew that, like, when that deal concluded or at the end of the 3 years, we would not be doing SportsCenter. I know I wasn't, right? I think Mike knew that too, but a true testament to who he is, you know, he wanted to fight it out because that's what we were used to doing. Just grind, fight it. And I certainly wasn't giving up, but I could see the future, and the future was not going to be us. We thugged our way through it as much and as long as we could. But the people were not, people didn't understand what the vision of the show
was. I was so excited when I saw that you guys did that Anchorman spoof. And I'm like, okay, they're going to be able to, they're going to have the room and the resources to play with the space and to apply their sensibilities to a daily making of something that can be a little lighter or a little darker, but a little lighter.
Well, it's sort of, you know what? It reminds me that I just thought this analogy is probably stupid, but I'm just going to say it anyway. It's like the people that don't know that LL Cool J used to be a rapper. Or the people that don't remember when Michael Jackson was, like, for real black. You know what I'm saying? It's like there were people who, and this is what made that transition to six so awkward, who had never seen His and Hers and did not realize what they were getting.
Oh, my God. So they're turning on SportsCenter, and instead they're getting the barbecue.
Exactly. It's like we were the cookout.
I didn't want to go to a cookout. I just wanted to see sports highlights. Right. Why are these two people here at the cookout?
Right, exactly.
And they're so loud, and they're black.
Like, why do they have pictures of Biggie and Obama in the back? Like, what's going
on? This is not the cookout I signed up for. Where's Tom Meese? Where's Chris Berman? What kind of cookout is this?
And if you our very first show, we did a spoof on Golden Girls, you know, and we did as our intro. And then we really hit them with some black shit when we did, we recreated Different World as a SportsCenter intro, and we had the original Different World cast in there, with the exception of Kadeem Hardison and Jasmine Guy. We had everybody. We had Sinbad, Dawn
Lewis. That's a big effort. That's a big effort.
Oh man, that was,
that's one of the blackest moments in the history of ESPN.
Had to be. No, although I would say the blackest moment, honestly, is when I drank a 40 on television. I really did.
I wonder why the show didn't survive.
But I didn't do it on SportsCenter. I did it on Instagram, all right? I did it at the cookout.
No, if you'd done it on Twitter, you would have also gotten let go.
Like, totally.
Just because you could do it on His and Hers doesn't give you carte blanche to do it wherever you want.
No, because that was the original cookout show for sure. But yeah, no, we did that. And, you know, the viral response was amazing. But there were a lot of people who were like, why the f*** is the Different World on SportsCenter? Like, what's happening?
Also a reasonable question, by the way.
I know. We didn't really have a good answer for that. We're like, f*** it, let's just do it. We're going to do Perfect Strangers. We had a list of them we were going to do.
That's funny.
And do a different one every month. But unfortunately, the demands of the show, just trying to get it right, just trying to get it clean on a day-to-day basis, sort of sapped our creativity for a while.
Is there, if I don't even know how to file this as an expression, was the show too black?
No, it wasn't. It just had two really black people on there, you know. But it wasn't as if we were, you know, alienating white people anyway. We were still talking about sports. That was the other total.
Well, that's the other thing.
Lie you guys about
are both,
our show.
You guys are both incredible sports dorks.
Right.
Incredible sports dorks.
So we were talking about sports 90% of the time. And
it's not like you were on there talking black issues
no,
or something. If issues came up where you noticed the black perspective, you might put it in there, but that was not the tenor of the show.
It never was. And in fact, I can't tell you how many times we turned down doing Colin Kaepernick related topics. Every day, every time, as you know, when a quarterback was signed, it became a Colin Kaepernick topic because he obviously wasn't in the NFL.
Jamel, it must be so frustrating to you to get swallowed by some of this stuff.
Well, I mean, you know, that's the thing. When you're when you're black and in a prominent position, you're just ultimately going to lead to you pissing everybody off, because you'll go through that moment in your career where the black people don't feel like you're riding hard enough for them, where the white people are like, oh, you're a racist, you're riding too hard for the black people. So you're always caught in this impossible sandwich sometimes. And it's a responsibility that a lot of us in prominent positions have. It's a responsibility, though, that I welcome. And I'm okay with doing that. And I'm okay with bringing a black perspective, a perspective of a black woman, I should say, to anything that I do, because that's my everyday life. So it's never something that I look at and think of, oh, this is too much or this is a burden. Sometimes it's frustrating. Don't get me wrong, but it's something that's necessary and I don't mind being the person to do it.
I remember having a conversation with Bomani. I had not considered this before Bomani had said it, which is Jamel has it worse than all of us. Then, you know, I'll get a small portion of it because get this dumbass Mexican old guy off my screen. It's very, very small. Bomani, what he gets hit with every day is something that makes me sad at my core. And Bomani's like, no, no, no. But I've got it easy compared to what Jamel has had to do. It's one of the many reasons that I admire you, because I understand you had to climb through a whole lot of garbage to get to where it is that you are, and you earned it.
Yeah, it's funny because when I left ESPN, the amount of dancing on my grave was pretty interesting to see. I knew it was going to be there, and for a lot of people, they're just like, oh, you know, thank God they ran her out of there and all this other stuff. And so there is some level of psychological trauma, I'm sure, that if I sat down and thought about too long, that's there based off the fact that you feel like that there you do. What happens is you walk around thinking people really hate you.
It made me want to hug you though. It made me want to hug the specifics of the dancing on the grave because I know that you're the accidental activist, and all you're doing is doing a job on SportsCenter that you were asked to do, and because you didn't really want any of this, but you're not going to run from any of it either.
No.
I feel sad for that portion of it, that there are so many, that most of the people dancing on the grave don't have nearly enough information to actually know what they're celebrating.
No. And for some reason, there was a huge segment or enough of a segment of people who obviously are looking at me as some sort of a threat or as, you know, somebody who is deserving to be hated. And it's just such a contrast to my real life, you know, where I have great friends and great family, and most of them would describe me as probably the most laid back, easygoing person ever. But yet it feels like I naturally come to inspire this vitriol, which is so perplexing to
me
at times.
But it's not just an inspiring of vitriol, though, because now you've found yourself in a pretty cool part of your career that's not newspapering, but probably partly why you got into newspapering is your also just inspiring, period. Now you're walking around and you are legitimately inspiring people in a way that you might not have been before, no matter how nice the story was you wrote or nice story you told. Now you walk into certain rooms where the vitriol isn't and you're a bit of a conquering hero.
Yeah, and that too feels awkward because and some of it depends on what you've known for, right? And so I saw Gabrielle Union say this when she came out with her book, and she obviously in her book, she talks about, you know, the fact that she was raped and, you know, what that psychological trauma did to her and how it impacted her life. Now, as a result of sharing that, when she's out in the public space, women come up to her all the time and tell her these horrible stories of how they've been assaulted and violated. And she, of course, wants to be a sounding board and to listen to that. But she's absorbing that at the same time while still, you know, having to had process her own trauma, right? And that's a lot. So with me, because I'm known as being the person who stuck it to the president and called him a white supremacist, people are coming up to me and telling me awful stories about racism and race and, you know, sort of looking to me to help them figure this out and how they're being treated. And that comes with its own level of trauma as well. So whereas before, if I were out and about, people would say, hey, what you said about the Jets sucked. That was garbage. I'd be like, all right, whatever. You can move on from that. But some of the things I'm being told now, harder to move on. And it puts me in a different headspace when I meet people.
Well, you don't seem like the type that likes to be famous.
No, not really. I don't at all. And, you know, you have these, and also with, you know, younger journalists, especially journalists of color, and women in particular, you know, they look at me as...
You're a hero. You are
as
a
that.
Hero.
And that feels bizarre.
A hero.
It's like, that feels really,
like
really bizarre.
Like you're a pioneer, though, but you know it. You knew it when you were counting the number of columnists that weren't black and female.
Right. But it does, where I'm able to relate and certainly understand their perspective, because it reminds me of how I looked at Claire Smith, how I looked at Donna Britt, how I looked at so many of the amazing female journalists in sports and out of sports when I was that age. You know, how I looked at Jeanette Howard. Like, I idolized them. I wanted to be like them so I can understand it. It just feels bizarre when you're on the receiving end.
I think it's funny, though, that you couldn't, even though your work would merit all of the company of all of those women and in some cases exceeds it, that the reason that you have now topped them in terms of whatever hierarchy there is in pioneering is this reason. It's not a journalism reason.
And I didn't want to pull it, sir.
It's because you called the president a white supremacist, which isn't something you hadn't said before, and I also thought was something I had been reading it so much from Ta-Nehisi Coates already that I didn't even see the insult in it because of the way that he writes about it, which is, look, white supremacy is something that has reigned supreme in this country since it started.
Well, what was Coates' article, The Most American President, where he just broke down every reason why Donald Trump was a white supremacist, right?
And people just jumped from that to she's calling him a Klansman. And I thought Ta-Nehisi had already made that a part of the lexicon that was accepted.
I thought I was saying water was wet. I didn't even think it was controversial. That gets back to the point. I did.
Amazing.
I swear to
you
God.
You thought you were just repeating something that was so common in your circles that you didn't. Wow. So the boulder, you had no idea what you were sending into the galaxy.
Because this is how you know I had no idea, Dan. I was in the middle of a Twitter conversation. I was replying to somebody. Like, if I was really trying to make a bold statement, I'd have added the damn president. I didn't. I was just talking casually with somebody.
So all you were doing was echoing somebody else's thought. It wasn't even your thought.
It wasn't even original. This was so crazy. I got famous for saying something that wasn't original. It wasn't new. It was not breaking news. It was like, I thought we all decided this after Charlottesville. Oh, we didn't. Okay, my bad. Some of you still holding out hope. Didn't realize that.
I can't even imagine. You were telling me the story the last time you were down here. I can't even imagine how your mother reacted to all of this.
Yeah. Yeah. She was not happy, obviously, because the person who she really just would probably fade on sight is Sarah Huckabee Sanders, because that was the person who said, oh, it was fireable, you know, then and said that. She wasn't quite as upset when the president tweeted about me, but she was really upset with Sarah Huckabee Sanders. And yeah, she called the White House. She did. Look, don't piss off a black mama, man. You never know, man. But she called the White House. And as I said to her, what did you think they were going to say back? Did you think they were going to put you through?
Well, who was she calling for?
Did you call and ask to speak to Sarah? Or like, is Mr. Trump in? Like, wait, what?
It was maternal anger that mm-hmm. needed to be expressed somewhere.
She did. She wanted to go off and say, how dare you do this to my baby? And yeah, so she called, and I was just like, why? I just didn't know what result she expected. And it was funny because in the time since, anytime something happens, like, she swears it might be a government conspiracy. She's like, I think you're still on their radar. When I went to the airport, this happened. I'm like, I don't think they're checking for you. I don't. I mean, I know that, you know,
your mother's under surveillance.
She thinks she is. Cause she had like some issue. Cause she went back to school to get her master's, right? She's almost like very close to finishing it. And it was some issue with her student loan, and she swore it was the government. And I was like, it's not the government.
Probably not the government.
It's not. They're not surveilling you. And she's just like, just be careful because you never know. I'm like, I'm not going to get assassinated, but I like this thing happening.
Yes, let's hope not.
I know. I'm not a political figure. Like, this is not going to happen.
You must marvel looking back at what has happened to your life since then.
I know.
Because how would you explain to people, when you say your life changed from one minute to the next, what are the details of that people could understand?
Man, I've had TMZ run up on me like 4 times. I don't know how they found me, but they did. You know, knowing that I have to think about that when I land in LA now is crazy. It's like, oh, I actually have to think about TMZ might jump out on me. You know, the amount that I've been scrutinized, I've been a walking think piece, you know, and my friends in the business, they crack up at the fact that outlets reach out to them saying, hey, can you come on and talk about her? And I'm like, this is so weird. Like, why, you know?
Fame is weird.
Yeah, it's very bizarre. And that's it. But it also honestly has led to some really cool experiences, very cool experiences. And I've gotten to know people whose art and work I've admired from afar, like Donald Glover, for example.
Oh, that has to be surreal to you.
Oh, it is. When celebrities tell you that they're inspired.
Not just celebrities. That celebrity.
Yeah.
Like that celebrities whose art inspires you.
Yeah.
Like when that person takes an interest in your work.
It's crazy. So I was at the Black Panther premiere, and I think he walked up to me. And he was just like, I love everything you stand for. And I was like, oh my God, it's Donald Glover. And
does Donald Glover know what you stand for though?
I have no idea, but he told me he did and I believed him. I'm just going with it. I'm like, yes, Donald, I stand for that.
Whatever that thing is you're thinking, that's what I stand for.
He could have been like, she stands for Captain Crunch Mars. I'd have been like, yeah, I stand for that.
Cause you're Donald Glover.
So we get into a great conversation. We exchange numbers and, you know, we would text every now and again, and I was in LA. And I get a text from him out of nowhere. And he's just like, hey, if you're getting this text, it's because I just want a couple cool people to come hang out, you know, no stress, just chilling, just good vibe. And if you know cool people who you think I would like, bring them too. I was like, okay.
That sounds like how he would do that.
Right. And he was like, when you get to this particular hotel, like it was some code name.
That's right. Of course.
And it was
a secret flume. You have to go.
Right. It was like the most Hollywood shit ever. Right. So that part of it was. So I asked for the fake name, and all of a sudden a hotel guy leads me down. Cause I took my boyfriend with me, leads us down this.
Well, he must be loving all of that. He's getting parties.
Let me tell you what he loves in particular. I'll get to that story in a minute, but. So he leads us down this ivy path and up these steps, and it's a hotel that kind of looks like the room looks like a Residence Inn. So I walk in the room and it's maybe 15 people there. You know, it's drinks. It looks like a hotel party we used to throw back in the day, right? And it's Tracee Ellis Ross. It's Kenya Barris. It's, Lakeith Stanfield, you're just, Zoe Kravitz.
You're sort of absorbing
and
these
faces.
I'm
like, wait,
I've been invited to the coolest place on earth.
Like, are you kidding me?
I'm not one of these people. I'm the Orlando journalism dork. How am I here?
Something does not belong in this room, and it's me. And it's like producers who have done famous things that I don't really know who they are. And I'm like, I don't even know how to act in this room. I didn't even know.
But your boyfriend had no problem.
No, he was. We were both kind of, you know, like, okay, this is who is in this room. All right, let's act like we've been here before.
You were trying to play cool.
We had to, because even though the inside, I'm freaking out. Like, oh my God, it's Tracy Ellis Ross. Like,
how is this my life?
And Lakeith Stanfield. I just want to talk to him about so many things. I'm freaking out. I'm like trying to. I'm like, oh hey, what's up? You know, like, come on, man. I gotta have my dignity.
No, but why?
I can't be acting like a fan in there. I can't.
But you're one of them now. If he knights you, if Donald Glover knights you, you're knighted. Like, you're one of the cool people who's invited to the cool people party.
I said hello to some people. I'd met Kenya Barris before, so that at least that wasn't awkward. And then I just, I just went and made a drink.
What is the story?
And we stood against the wall. Yeah, and then we started mingling, you know, very naturally. And honestly, the best part was, you know, we got into our comfort zone. We started acting like regular people. And eventually it was me, my boyfriend, Donald Glover, somebody in the PR realm, I feel like. And it's just the four of us. And we talked to like 2 or 3 in the morning. And it was awesome. Right? I was a normal person.
But you weren't able to tell any of these other people how you felt about them?
No, because I did. I felt like so stupid. I felt so stupid, like telling Tracy Ellis Ross, like, you're dynamite. I felt so dumb. So I did. But you mentioned my boyfriend, and he must be loving the access. Of course, you know, like, we both, you know, kind of like being able to have these opportunities, and we don't take them for granted. What he loves, though, is that now, because I've become a famous person, people are actually giving a shit about my romantic life. And the funniest story, some gossip blog wrote about us or whatever. They clearly took some of our vacation pictures from my Instagram. And the headline was Jemele Hill getting serious with hunky boyfriend.
They didn't even know his name. That's okay, but he'll take hunky boyfriend.
Oh, no. Trust me, in his group chat with his friends, he could not wait to screenshot that and send it to him. Like, I'm the hunky boyfriend. And I was like, are you kidding me? I was like, you got to be kidding me.
You've got a boy toy, a hunky boyfriend, a hunky boy toy.
Because the funny thing is that when we first started, you know, dating and getting a little bit more serious, we took a few photos or whatever, and I tagged him in it. But I learned not to tag him, you know, just because I don't want anybody, you know, I just don't want the drama. I don't want him to have to deal with what I have to deal with on a daily basis. You know, he's a civilian. He didn't ask for this life. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, his page is private, but, you know, when I did that, the number of requests that he got all of a sudden, plus, not going to lie, I don't want all these other chicks over me.
That's a lot of
I'm not going to lead them to him, man.
That's hunky boyfriend. You can't leave hunky boyfriend on social media.
He's going to have some groupies. No, that can't happen. But yes, he is hunky boyfriend, and we treat him sort of like Mr. Big from Sex and the City, right? So I never say his name or anything like that. And so, but he's hunky boyfriend. But I did tell him, I often tell him that, like, you know, that if we break up, you will die alone. Only because you'll never find anybody that could ever measure up to me.
That would be really hard.
It would be
he lived it with you.
We've gone to the White House twice. You know, he had 2 presidential pictures. Okay. Clearly not the current White House, but the last one.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So he would not have access to these circles if not for you.
She's never going to add up. Don't even just die alone. Die alone.
What is the compliment that you get that means the most to you when some stranger comes up to you and thanks you for something you've done?
You know, usually the compliment that strikes me is one that's actually about my work, the thing that I do, and not the thing that I represent. So if somebody says, oh, I remember that interview you did with such and such, or that story you did about such and such, that means a lot.
I don't think people understand that about you. Like that you would think it nicer, Hey, I read that thing that you wrote in the Orlando Sentinel.
Right.
20 years ago.
Totally. Or even something I wrote for The Undefeated when I was writing for them. I get a lot of joy out of that because, you know, that's what I got into this.
Well, it's who you are, right? Yeah. Like that, it has more to do with who you're. If you indeed get any of your identity from your work, your self-worth would be as the writer, would be as the journalist. It would not be this mess that brought you fame. It would be in the dirty work in the shadows, just, you know, reporting something against the deadline at midnight.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the part that brings me joy. That's why I got in this business. I got in the business for the parts that aren't glamorous or that make you famous at all. In fact, when we were getting into business, you knew you weren't ever going to get famous. You were never going to make money.
I really did. I really thought that newspapers were the end of it, that
me
there
too.
Was no money in this job. There would be no money.
I thought to me making it was if I got paid 50 grand a year.
Mm-hmm.
I was if I could make 50 grand a year, I was like, oh my God.
Mine was 35 grand.
Yours is 35?
Yeah.
Damn, think higher of yourself.
I thought they're going to pay me to write things. Like, that's silly. They shouldn't pay for that. That's
right.
Like, it's just me writing things. Why would you pay for that? Anything for it.
Exactly. I was like, 50 grand, I'm good. Yeah. And so, and 50 grand just was such a status symbol to me.
You imagine if even 5 years ago, I'd come to you and said, look, Jamel, here's how your life is going to change. Even 5 years ago.
Right.
You wouldn't have had it looking anything like this, right?
Oh, my God, no. I mean, the goal 5 years ago was to try to get on TV every day, you know, because I realized that, you know, with everything happening and the changes in our business and changes specifically at ESPN, you know, that I probably needed, my next step needed to be doing television every day. And so that was it. That was really the end game. And, you know, we did His and Hers / Numbers Never Lie for like 2 years. If at the start of His and Hers, you would have told me you're going to be a SportsCenter anchor, I'd have laughed in your face, like hard. And in fact, the first time they even said it, we both laughed because they're like, that's ridiculous. Like, why would we be SportsCenter anchors? That's not us. We're not anchors, you know, and there's a long legacy of incredible SportsCenter anchors. And we were just like,
but it was such a good idea, though. It really was. Let's get the two young black people who have chemistry and let them be themselves on television.
It seemed like a good idea at the time.
It really did.
Like the perfect
Let's
idea.
End on that note. It really did. It seemed like such a good idea at the time.
It's like, yeah, black people, youth. Bring a perspective.
Yeah,
fighting the man at 6 o'clock.
Fighting the man. No,
not
mind.
So much.
Never mind. Jamel, thank you for hanging out with us.
Thank you.